And welcome again to Brew Crew Online. I'm Benjamin Orr.
I'm Colin Bennett.
And the trend for the Brewers lately has not been a pretty one, losing 5 out of 6 games to the 2 worst teams in baseball. Not saying that they're bad, I'm just saying they have bad records this year, but it has not been, you know, all sunshine and roses for the Brewers. We've had a lot of problems. The offense has been keeping, you know, the Brewers in games and has been trying to do that. But ultimately, it's the same thing we've been seeing all season, the bullpen.
Right, and it's a different member of the bullpen, you know, making a mistake every game. It doesn't matter who we put out anymore, which is almost comforting in a way. And hear me out on this.
No, cause I'm not thinking I agree with you.
If it was just Frankie, or if it was just Axford, you know, then I'd have to give up the ghost a little bit, and I'd have to say, you know, all right, maybe it's time that we ship Axford, or, you know, we're already getting rid of Frankie, so maybe it's time that I just stop worrying about him. But it's not. It's him, it's Axford, it's Cameron Lowe, it's Jose Veras, it's Jim Henderson now is the newest one to wear the collar. You know, it's everybody, and every day. Every day after the games, I read the raps, I read the box scores, I try to figure out, you know, the story of the game. And then I go down to the comments to hear all the people that are either bandwagoners or just love hating on the Brewers or, you know, whatever it is. Because, you know, there's only a couple type of people that comment. And a lot of people there have a nice knit community and are very respectful, but there's a lot of bandwagon type of people that comment on there, and every single time it's like, oh, Renicki shouldn't have put this guy in, we should have put this guy in. And then, like, every comment is like, he shouldn't have put A in, and he should have put X in instead. And then the next day he's like, shouldn't have put X in, he should have put A in. And it's, you know, it's funny. I've never seen a manager hogtied like this.
You know, and I've seen a trending thing on Twitter before was fire Ron Renicki, and I'm thinking, why? He doesn't have anybody else to choose from. Who's he gonna have pitch? Aoki? I mean, really?
Right.
Well,
right.
I mean, I think at this point, you really, why not? But
someone called into the, I don't have cable right now, so I listen to the games on WTMJ. Someone called in and was like, you know, why is Renicki pulling pitchers so early, blah, blah, blah. These guys can all do, you know, so many innings and blah, blah, blah. And, I took a look at, you know, some of their career standings and funny enough, Greinke really never went over like 7 innings in his career. Markham never really went over 7 innings in his career. It's not complete games are really hard to come by, you know, and that's an easy way to ruin a game just the same as putting in the bullpen. He really has, you know, looking at this team, it's a horse apiece. You lose it by bringing your pitcher along, or you lose it by bringing in the bullpen at this point. In my mind, it would be easier to hope that the bullpen can turn it around, only using one of them for an inning and a half, as opposed to giving more long-term damage to a starter by having him go 8 instead of 6.
Yeah, because that way, if you have, you know, Markham, say when he's back, you know, that's a good example, actually. Markham, when he comes back from whenever his injury is, you know, healed, you look at that and you have him go 8 innings instead of his 6, you risk him for more injury. You're going to overexhaust your pitchers doing that. I mean, you're a team that's no longer in contention with anything. So,
exactly.
I mean, if it were a different scenario and you were going full force, then I'd say, yeah, pitch Gallardo 8, pitch Markham 7, you know, pitch Fire 7-8. You know, I think at that point, I think it depends on where you stand in the division and in the wild card race.
Yeah.
But the Brewers have nothing to play for right now, and there's no point in trying to injure these guys long term just to win 2 games out of 5. I mean,
right. That's the other thing too, is you have to think about the pitcher themselves and the rhythm that they are in. When Fires went 8 innings against the Reds, you know, he had a perfect game going through 6. Then he had a one hitter going through, you know, 7 innings or whatever it was. You know, they have a rhythm and they've established a dominance for the team. There hasn't been a period in lots of those periods where they're like, oh, well, you know, we should have sent X pitcher so long into the game. They didn't have that same kind of rhythm where they were just taking down batters. You know, even Greinke never. I mean, Greinke had a lot of really, really good starts, but there was rarely a truly dominant performance that he was putting in where you could have said, yeah, he should have had the complete game there. Because if you start to get shaky in those later innings, especially if you're getting, a little hairy or you're getting into full counts in the sixth inning, there's something wrong with your rhythm at that point. You know, you're trying to force in a strike and people aren't chasing it or whatever, and that's going to affect you moving forward.
You know, speaking of people, you know, not chasing strikes, we've seen that happen how many times to Axford this year. You know, he always throws that one pitch and gets hammered. But, you know, other than that, he is still doing the same job he was last year. And, you know, it's just that one pitch that happens. You know, and I'm not saying, you know, that bullpen guys are more prone to it than, you know, starters. But in a sense, they are, because you get later in the game, it's a one-run game. The other team, if you're leading, right, the other team is going to want to try to do everything they can to get back into the game. So, you know, they're going to be smarter about what they're swinging at. They're not going to, you know, if there's a borderline pitch, they're going to foul it off. They're not going to take it. They're going to foul it off. They're going to try to do everything they can to get on base. And And, you know, and there's an approach that Ron Washington has from Texas, and he says he doesn't take his guys out unless he thinks they need to be taken out. In Monday's game, he had Ryan Dempster go 7 innings, and Ryan Dempster ended up giving up 8 runs.
Right.
And I don't know if it's a confidence issue that Washington has with his pitchers, or if it's just a thing to where he realizes that, you know, pitchers sometimes can go those extra innings, but Renicki doesn't see that because Renicki is a different manager. He looks at it in the fact that, you know, my guys aren't built the same way. Texas, right, is a team built on pitching. You have Nolan Ryan, who's like around the head of the team, so he knows how to factor in those people. Renicki doesn't have that, you know, with Doug Melvin. So Renicki has to factor it in on his own. I understand the philosophy that Warren Washington uses, but I don't think it works for every team, and I think that's what, right, a lot of people expect Renicki to do with their starters, and you just can't do that. Our guys aren't expendable like that.
Well, yeah, and especially this year, if you can't preserve your starting pitching, Renicki has nothing left, you know? If he can't keep his starters working as close to top form as possible, he doesn't have, you know, we can't afford to hang out a starter to dry this year, you know, to just look at, say, Mike Fiers or Mark Rogers or whatever and just say, listen, you got to take one for the team today, guys. The bullpen's spent, you need to go at least 6, and good luck to you. We can't really afford to do that, you know?
Yeah, and at this point, it doesn't matter if the bullpen's spent or not. It's just they're giving up runs regardless.
Right.
I mean...
And you have to try... You have... It seems counterintuitive, I think, but to me, it kind of makes sense where you can't... you can't not give it to your bullpen, you know, as much as possible. You do need to try to keep putting them in situations, because if they can't work themselves out of it, it's not doing anybody any favors, really. You have nothing to really lose at this point if you're the Brewers. You know, we still have the 6th highest attendance in the National League. People are still watching the games, and you're still in every game. So, you know, you have to try to get the bullpen to work out of a funk, because you're not going to be able to move these guys next year.
You know, and the thing that we can ask mainly from our starters is just to keep us in the game for around 6 innings. Because if they can at least keep us in the game, there's hope, and I know that hope's kind of faded by this point, you know, the bullpen holding, you know, leads, because we've seen evident as to many times the Brewers will have a 6-1 lead heading into the 7th or 8th, and the Brewers end up losing 7-6. Happened 3 times in the Philadelphia series. It has happened to where the Brewers are up 6-1 and the Brewers end up winning 6-5. It's happened a few times. I think I remember watching a game back in June, I think that happened. But, you know, we know what the problem is. And, you know, the offense is giving it all it has. The starting pitching is giving it all it has. And it's the bullpen. You can't make it any clearer than that. You just really can't. Everybody in this bullpen is struggling.
You bring up kind of an important point in what you just said. It's hard for us to try to remember that, you know, It's not that the bullpen's not giving it everything they have. It's just that what they have this year doesn't match up to what they had last year. And it's really hard to tell why. You know?
You know, we talk all the time about how, oh, we lost Saito and Hawkins. And, you know, but last year we still had Axford, we still had Frankie, we still had Parra, we had Mike McClendon for a little bit. You know, it wasn't that much different. I mean, yeah, you know, obviously the one guy that's not there right now is Tim Diller because he's in AAA. But, I mean, other than that, I mean, this bullpen isn't really that much different, except with the additions of Hernandez, Henderson, and Veras.
Right.
And I don't think three guys really make or break a bullpen, especially if you had three or four solid people already there the previous year that got you to the NLCS.
Right. And you know, really, last year, Frankie and Axford got us to the NLCS. I mean, there's no question about that. The way that they pitched on the stretch and all year, really, minus the first couple months of Axford's season, which everyone was a little concerned about him again. You know, they really were the motivating factor in terms of, like, you know, give us the ball at the end of the game and you're going to watch us win. And that's just what happened. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it's obviously a much different story than last year. But, you know, Brewers, you know, still can play with their heads high, you know, at least finish out the season strong. And a big part of that is, you know, this series now with Philadelphia, another four-game series. You know, we're back at home where we are doing well this season, but, you know, we do face, you know, Philly's good pitchers. We do face Hamels. We face Worley, who's kind of off the mark of where he was last year. And
right.
We face Cliff Lee tonight. You know, I think
Cliff Lee gets battered against Milwaukee, though. Cliff Lee's last, like, his lifetime stats against Milwaukee are not great.
You know, it's always when you say that, you know, like when you watch a baseball game and say, oh, this guy hasn't hit a home run, you know, X amount of at-bats, and then he hits a home run. It's kind of a thing. Like, Cliff Lee's going to, like, go seven strong and allow one hit or something, strike out 15. I mean,
we'll throw out as many scenarios as possible now just to confuse the universe on what's going to happen.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of just that at this point, you know. I think we can match up a little bit. We have tomorrow night's game, we have Gallardo going against Worley, and Saturday we have Fires going against Hamels. So I think those two matchups can do well. Tonight's kind of a mismatch, but, I mean, if history factors in at all with Cliff Lee struggling against Milwaukee, maybe I'll give some leeway for Marco Estrada to do well. And
yeah.
Sunday, I'm not really expecting much out of that. Kyle Kendrick versus Randy Wolf. Not expecting much out of that. This Philly series, I think, is more so in the advantage of the Phillies, because last time we played them, Philly was just absolutely awful, and now they have a better record than us. So, maybe Philly gets the advantage in this series, but Milwaukee does play well at home. They did last year, they did this year, but...
Philly's dealing with a lot of injuries, both immediate and kind of nagging injuries as well. You have Polanco just went down a little bit ago. You know, Ryan Howard was injured earlier. Everyone basically on the lineup at some point has spent time out or is no doubt playing with an ache or a pain or two. And, you know, the team's really aging. It's interesting. I'm very interested to see how the Phillies do down the stretch, because that's going to say a lot about what they do in the future, more so than I think, you know, the Brewers in this series. I think in terms of the Brewers, you have a lot of pitchers that you have pitchers playing throughout this series that are kind of looking to find their way still in this season. So it would be a good this is a good opportunity for these pitchers, you know, Estrada. And Fires especially, to kind of get somewhere, you know, in terms of the future.
Yeah, and you look at Philly and the fact that, like you said, this, you know, we'll see how they do in the next few years. You know, Philly's bullpen in the past 3-4 years has been one of the worst, because they just have not found anything that works. You know, they tried What's his name? Brad Lidge. They tried him in the closer role. That didn't turn out well. They went to another closer. Now they're with Jonathan Papelbon. And, Philly is just... It's bad in the bullpen. You have Carlos Ruiz on the DL, who was just destroying the ball.
Philly, in terms of their bullpen pitching, is always spending like a dollar too much, a year too late.
Yeah, I mean, Papelbon, I've never really been that impressed with, because especially with, Boston's collapse last year and how he was a big part of that, especially in September, that raises some concern there. And, talking about guys on the DL, Ruiz and Polanco. Polanco's always on the DL, though, so that's not really a surprise. Nate Sherholtz, who they got in the trade for Hunter Pence from the Giants, is also on the DL. So they're having to go with a lot of guys that they're not used to playing.
Getting rid of Hunter Pence, I don't understand.
I think
he seemed like a guy that you would want as a core guy moving forward, but...
Well, I don't know if it's an issue of money because of how much they're paying Cole Hamels now, and Roy Halladay's salary isn't cheap, and Cliff Lee's not cheap. Mm-hmm.
So. I think what you're watching with Philly is you're watching a team that was absolutely dominant, made some great deals, really worked themselves into a good position, won a couple championships, and then started chasing that feeling with more and more and more money and older stars, and then suddenly. Look where they are now. It might be a while until we see a Phillies team that's really, really good again.
And I would hate bringing up this comparison, but you look at what Steinbrenner did from the 70s on, and I think a lot of teams, Philadelphia and Boston in particular, tried to kind of mimic that and fell on their faces. Because you look at Boston last year and look at Boston this year. It's a team that's on the down spiral. You look at Philadelphia in the past few years, they're on a down spiral ever since winning the World Series in 2008. They get there in 2009 and lose. And, last year they're a first-round loss to the Cardinals. So, I mean, there's a lot going wrong with Philadelphia. And is it injuries? Yes, but I also think it's just people not performing like they used to. Chase Utley, I hate to say it to Phillies fans, is never going to be the same second baseman he ever was.
No.
He's aging. And age is not being kind to him at all. He's more injury prone than he ever was. He's not putting up the same numbers that he used to be. And, the only bright spot still for them is probably, Carlos Ruiz and maybe Ryan Howard. But, Ryan Howard is also struggling as well this year. And so I think there's a lot that Philly needs to work with. They're an aging team overall. And, they have some guys, they could possibly work with, that are in their farm system. Pitching wise, you have, J.C. Ramirez and Jacob Diekman, who I've heard their names a few times throughout the season.
Yeah, the Phillies seem just as happy though, like shuffling contracts between other teams to try to get the next big piece than they are from moving up their own guys from the farm system.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think the Brewers do very well is they take risks with their guys from the farm leagues, and I think the biggest example of that this year is Martin Maldonado. He wasn't ready to be up here. He was only up here because Lucroy went down and Kataris wasn't ready to catch every day. So we were like, okay, we have to bring up Maldonado. And he's done incredible. There's no point in ever sending him back to the minors. So he's up here to stay. And that's something Philly has never done. They've always thought, well, let's go and trade for this guy. Let's go and get this guy from free agency. And that destroys your farm system because you have guys then that you keep trading for and you have some of your top prospects that are no longer there because they're gone because you traded them. And now you have this pool of people in your minors and you're just like, wow, they're not ready. And soon they'll be 25, 26, 27 and they still won't be ready. And they'll be ready by the time they're 29 and then, their prime's already gone. So I think if you're Philly, you're going to have to take a season or two to try and rebuild your farm system. And you might suck in the process. You might still be in fourth or fifth in the East. But, in the long term, I think it's what you need to do. I mean, I think that's what the Brewers are trying to do right now. They made the playoffs for the first two times in their franchise in 2008 and 2011. And I think 2012 is showing us that, in order to keep trying to do that, we need to rebuild from what we had. So I think there's something, a mentality that Philly needs to take. And if Philly doesn't want to take that approach, then... you know, then you're going to be behind, you know.
Well, and there's one big reason why this is why it's going to be harder for the Phillies than it is for the Brewers. I think the Brewers fans have always known that we have a decent farm system. We have a very good farm system. But it takes time to see fruition, you know, on a major league level there. I don't think Philly fans, no offense to Philly fans listening, you know, generalization time here, but I don't think on the average, the average Philly fan will be willing to wait after the success that they had. That's not even necessarily a knock against Phillies fans. That's a knock against an organization that was so good for a good portion of this last decade, that suddenly, you know, isn't going to be good again for another half decade at least, you know? And are the fans willing to wait for that? I think a lot of heads are going to roll in Philadelphia fairly soon.
I think this is the point where the Cubs fans come in and kind of console the Philly fans. I mean, because you're like, the Cubs fans have been battered down for 100 years now or more.
Right.
You know, in the whole Steve Bartman thing a few years ago. And, you know...
Poor Bartman, Jesus.
I think the Cubs fans can console the Philly fans and say, we know how that goes. So, it's just, Philly is not going to be the dominant team they were for a few years. And, you know, I've heard, you know, playing in Philadelphia is one of the hardest places to play, regardless of whether you're a Philly or not.
Yeah.
I think just overall how the fans, and this happens everywhere. Like we said, we're just not generalizing Philadelphia. This happens in any big market, you know, field. But it's one of the hardest places to play. And I think, you know, I did one of the Series 6 packs, and I interviewed, I think it was John Solanas from the Phillies site. And I asked him, why are the Phillies playing so terribly at home? And he goes, well, the reason for that is because of all the pressure. And they're, you know, when they're on the road, they don't have that pressure. They don't have the home crowd bearing down on them. And when they're at home, they have all that, you know, tension and pressure to play under that they just collapse. So
that makes a good deal of sense, actually.
It really factors in. And I'm not saying fans make or break a game, but, you know, fans, like any other job in the world, are your business. If you don't have fans showing up to your game, then you're not selling anything, your sales are down, and your team's down because, you know, nobody's watching them play, and morale is just down overall.
Yeah. So. Well, which is a good sign, by the way, looking at the numbers for the attendance and projecting them forward. There's a very good chance that Milwaukee hits 3 million fans again this year, which is really nice for them. And, you know, it's something I think the fans still need to do. You still need to go out and support that team, even if they're playing as crappy as they are right now.
Yeah, that's why bandwagoners get underneath my skin, because it's just irritating. You just don't hop teams like that. Stick a team and pick with them.
Right. It's,
I said that backwards. Pick a team and stick with them.
you're very upset right now. It's
very.
speaking of being upset with people, what is going on with Ryan Braun lately?
You know, maybe it's just... Honestly, and I'm not making excuses for him, maybe he's tired out. You look at what he's done the entire season, not just, you know, half of it or three-fourths of it, the entire season. And he has carried this offense tremendously.
Right.
He carried it through April, he carried it through May, and then when Lucroy went down, you know, Ramos Ramirez and Norichika Oki stepped up. But the main force of it was Braun. I think he's just tired.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at his. Let's just take his last 10. He's only hit in. Well, he's hit in 5 of 10. Only one of them has been a multi-hit game, and he has 14 strikeouts in 10 days. That's something we've never seen from him.
He's also now batting .299.
Yeah, .143 over his last 10.
You know, it has not really been pretty for Braun at all. You know, he's faced, you know, Cincinnati and St. Louis at the beginning of that. And didn't have any hits. He had one hit in the entire span of games.
Yeah.
He got 4 hits in the series against Houston, 1 in the series against Colorado so far, but he's not playing today, actually.
He is getting the day off today, yeah.
Or no, yesterday, I'm sorry. But, you know, it's just... I don't know. Maybe it's a mental thing with guys going through a season like this. But, I mean, I don't think there's any concern for him, certainly. I think Braun will pick it up again. But, you know, it's just mental exhaustion. Guys, you know, get into this rhythm. And I think Braun... I think it was kind of apparent mid-July that Braun's rhythm was kind of slipping a little bit. Because you start to see his average go from, you know, like 319 down to, you know, 309 and then 304. And you're just like, well, what's going on with Braun? So, right. You know, I've been asked that before, too. I'm just like, people would say, well, hey, what's going on with Ryan Braun? I'm just thinking, I don't know. I mean, if I had to say something, I'm going to have to say it's mental exhaustion. It happens with the guys. It happens, you know, with offensive guys. It happens with the pitchers. And, you know, it's a little bit apparent when it happens with offensive guys because they play every day. And if they don't get a hit in three or four games, people start questioning that. And,
right.
You know,
I wonder if it's just as much, like, I don't disagree with the mental exhaustion part, but I wonder if it's not just as much, like, you know, he's starting to push to try to keep this team in games, you know, that maybe he's putting some of that extra pressure on himself to make something happen. You know, which would explain, I think, the strikeouts more than anything else.
Yeah, because when you try too hard, then it's just bad. But the fortunate thing about that is this year he's batting .583 against the Phillies, with two doubles, four RBIs, and two home runs. So maybe he'll turn it around in this series. But, you know, with the way Aramis Ramirez has been playing, though, I think... we don't have much to be concerned about with Braun because we have Lucroy back, we have Ramirez doing good, we have Hart turning it around, we have Aoki doing well. So there's a lot of guys in this lineup that I think if Brian Braun takes a little bit of a tumble, it isn't really going to halt the production as much as people would think it would.
Right, and Gene Segura is getting his bat nice and warm these days too.
Yeah, you gotta love that. You know, I mean, if we're getting rid of Greinke for somebody, it better be somebody who can hit. So
yeah.
So fortunately, Gene Segura has been able to do that. You know, moving on to our next topic, I guess it can be related to Ryan Braun, is Melky Cabrera and his getting busted yesterday and the whole PED thing.
Yeah, busted for testosterone levels.
And the thing about it is... Colin and I had discussed this before, you know, with our 16-minute pre-show, about how Cabrera literally came out and said, yeah, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. You know, he admitted up to it, and, you know, obviously he doesn't excuse what he did, but, you know...
There's something admirable in that, I think. I don't know, maybe I'm old-fashioned that way, but, you know...
I don't think it's admirable, just as... It should just be there. If you made a mistake like that, you should admit to it. And 90% of the guys won't. But, I mean, I just think it's kind of expected that guys should admit to something like that, especially if you helped, you know, the NL win the All-Star game. I mean, literally, if he's not a part of that, the NL, I don't think, wins that All-Star game, or at least doesn't win it by 8 runs.
Right. And now a lot of people, there hasn't been much discussion about it. Maybe that gives Ryan Braun the NL MVP in the All-Star game. I don't know if you can retroactively award those things, you know. But there's going to be that discussion coming up. There's going to be the discussion about, you know, what happens to Melky, you know, going forward and what happens to everything he does in the past. You know, it's always a difficult situation when you're faced with this. It's easy to just write guys off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just say, you know what, I'm done. I don't want to be a part of that anymore. Blah blah blah. I felt the same way for a little while with Ryan Braun when he, you know, when he got quote unquote caught earlier last year, even though it did end up being overturned. But it's difficult because I don't think we, in our perspective, it's easy to say, you know, to say these guys are wrong and this is. You know, this is what happened, and blah blah blah, and just forever cast them aside. And you know, it's just as easy to assume that there are a lot of other guys out there that are doing this that aren't getting caught. And then, if the difference between you keeping a job and you never finding a place in the majors again are those substances, I don't know how long it takes you before you start to consider it. It's a very complicated kind of issue. You know, I'd love to sit back and just, you know, climb into my ivory tower and say, like, oh, all these guys are cheaters and they're very, very wrong. But the truth is that it's not quite as black and white as that, you know, and I try to be understanding about it. But, you know, the other side of the coin is that's your employer. Those are the rules to keep a job. If I show up to my job, you know, 20 minutes late and I'm drunk every day, like, I'm going to get fired, you know? I expect to get fired if I get caught doing that. You know, on the other side of the coin, you have to say, like, well, how do you keep doing this if you know you're going, if you know what happens?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people say, well, do it till you get caught. But when you get caught, then you've been doing it for how many years, you've broken how many records, and things like that degree, or, you know, and with Melky Cabrera, you know, I think it was a little bit more apparent because you just don't go from playing 6 years in the majors and being a career 260, 270 hitter to a 320 hitter. That just doesn't happen overnight. You know, right. And the thing with Ryan Braun is, correct me if I'm not mistaken, but I think he's tested multiple times a week now for this.
I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't heard anything definite, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's been tested a lot.
I mean, I've heard, I don't know where I heard this, but I heard he's tested multiple times a week. But even if he is, he's putting up better numbers than last year. And Ryan Braun has been putting up these numbers his entire career. And he is not huge and muscular. And that's what a lot of people take as a misconception of steroids is, oh, you know, they're going to, you know, look like, you know, thumbnail one day, and then they're going to look like Hulk Hogan the next. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. So, I mean, you know, Ryan Braun is not on steroids. There's no way he's on steroids. He's been that type of hitter his entire career. Mm-hmm. He's tested thoroughly.
He's got a career average over 300. Decently over 300,
too. Melky Cabrera? I mean, that just doesn't happen with a guy. I mean...
Right. I mean, as an outfielder, it's not uncommon to see an outfielder suddenly flip the switch and turn on that power swing. You know, the power swing kind of alone. You know, look at Joey Batts in Toronto, yeah. Jose Bautista. I mean, he turned on that power switch. You know, as a corner outfielder or an outfielder in general, you tend to have that, you know, you have that need to be a power hitter. You know, you don't have a very, very high impact position, so you have to make those bigger impacts on offense, and so it's not terribly uncommon to see people suddenly kind of turn it on, like the way Melky Cabrera did. But he's not just hitting for power, you know. He's hitting for average and power now too. And it's I don't know. I don't want to say that I was ever really suspicious of Melky Cabrera because I've seen this happen with outfielders before. It's a little shocking though, because Melky's been such a decent guy. You know, he's in terms of ball players in the community and how they interact with the press and the fans. I mean, it's just not something that I really thought I'd see from him. And I guess that's the weirdest part. I feel like a parent right now. I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
You know, that's the thing. Was I was turning on the TV yesterday because I had an MLB Network, and I think I forget what game I was going to watch, but that's aside the point. But it was San Francisco and Washington, because it was Lincecum versus Strasburg, and I really want to see that. And the first thing I saw before that was breaking news, and I'm like, okay, what's the breaking news? And, like, Melky Cabrera has been suspended 50 games. And I'm like, what? I mean, I was in the boat that, wow, he's having a really good year. Steroids and Melky Cabrera before yesterday were not even remotely close in my mind. I would have never suspected of that. I just would have thought, you know, maybe he's turning around, like you said. And there are guys like Joey Batts who started off well and are now batting. I mean, he's on the DL, but he was batting like below 200s this season. He's still a power hitter, but just there are power hitters that hit for a low average because they just don't hit for contact. Melky Cabrera, we're talking about in 340s. I mean, I'm thinking, wow, he's doing great this year. And I found yesterday, I'm just like, wow. Like, I mean...
And then you make those connections instantly. You know, you start looking at the stats and you're like, oh, that's when he started right there. It was April 5th, 2010. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, I mean, honestly, I think this was kind of a huge punch in the gut for the MLB. I really think it was. A lot of people will say that, oh, it's a step going forward because, the drug joint administration or whatever it was, you know, is now doing their job and we're going to catch a lot more guys. But, I mean, when you see somebody suspended typically it's these minor leaguers that get busted for it. Not too many major leaguers, and not too many major leaguers that made a huge impact in the All-Star game or things like that. I mean, right. Now Melky Cabrera is tainted. He was supposed to be a free agent at the end of this year and still will be. And, you know, going into next year, teams are probably going to offer him, you know, 3 years for $33 million or 4 years for $45 million. That's all gone now. He's not going to get that.
See, I'm not so sure that someone's not going to take a chance on him. I understand the stigma that's attached with steroid use.
But they do take a chance on him. They're not going to pay him that kind of money, though. He lost that. They'll extend him. They'll, you know, offer him a three or four year contract, but maybe for like $20 million, not for $45 million with an extra signing bonus. He's not going to get that anymore. That's gone.
That's true, and he's going to have a lot more stipulations in his contract now. He's going to have to be a very, very good boy from here on out.
Yeah, you know, this kind of brings up, you know, just my personal opinion of being caught with, you know, levels of PEDs and things like that. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, you know, being a Brewers fan and talking about Ryan Braun in this way, but, you know, his was overturned. But if it isn't overturned, obviously Ryan Braun wanted it to be overturned because he wasn't on them. But Melky Cabrera admitted to it. If a guy admits to it, or they try to go for an arbitration case and it's failed, you know, like it hasn't before, I think the minimum should be suspended for 1 year without pay. You get caught again, you're suspended from baseball for life. I know that seems a bit extreme, but hear me out. We have too many people, probably that we don't know of right now, that are taking some levels of PEDs or, you know, have high levels of testosterone that other guys don't have.
Right.
And I hate seeing baseball being treated like this. I really do.
Yeah, I mean, you hate to see that, but you also have to, you know, we have to be, I don't want to use the term mature, because I'm not saying that your argument's not valid. What I'm saying, we have to be realistic in the fact that, you know, Babe Ruth was a big fan of amphetamines. Hank Aaron admitted that he tried at the time, you know, they were called greenies, essentially the same thing. He tried it, didn't like it, didn't use it, but it doesn't mean that someone like Eddie Matthews didn't use it or Herman Killebrew didn't do something. I mean, it's a different era of it, and it's certainly more scrutinized now and more tactically evaded by players. But it's still, I mean, it is still cheating. There's no question about that. But there's a lot of, you know, it's a dicey issue. It really is in my mind. I want the guys to be clean. I want them to play clean, and I want the game to be as I don't know, quote unquote, pure as possible. But in baseball, especially, it's never really been that way. If you take an honest view at it.
Well, yeah, I mean that's true. But I mean that doesn't mean that the MLB can't start a stance towards it and try to get rid of this and, you know, try to get out of the game permanently. I mean, what's done is done with guys like you brought up Herman Killebrew and Babe Ruth, guys like that. That what's done is done there. But, I mean, it doesn't mean that going forward you can't try to prevent this again to where you don't have these tainted records and have all these people up in the air about, you know, Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire, have all those kind of things. You know, it's just, if you want to avoid that, you need to crack down on severe punishments, because if guys see that and, like, well, I can't play anymore, then, you know, that's their fault and nobody else's. So, I mean, it sounds a bit extreme, but I think just starting off, you need to inflict stricter punishments. I think these slap on the wrist of players are nothing.
I think the three strike rule works pretty well. It's 50 games for the first, a year for the second, and then it's gone forever on the third. I mean, cutting the one strikeout isn't, you know, essentially making that much bigger of an impact. If people are still doing it anyways, I don't think making a harsher punishment is going to make that much bigger of a difference, in my mind.
Well,
because again, talking about the difference between millions and millions of dollars for years and being a AAA player for the next 5 years and having to leave baseball for life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those what-if things, you know, because I think it could instill some fear in these guys. But then again, maybe not. So it's kind of, you know, that double-edged thing right there. But, you know, I think it's going to be an issue, obviously, for the next few years, decades, that, you know, the MLB is going to struggle with. But, you know, I would like to see it toned down a little bit and eventually be gone from this game, because baseball is just such a in my mind, a pure game, that people that cheated, I have no tolerance for them.
Right. No, and I can understand that. And there are a lot of people like that. And mentalities do tend to shift over time. I mean, I think in 10 years, who knows what the attitude towards steroids is going to be. You know? I mean, it's, will it ever be like, oh, here, there's going to be, you know, just bottles and jars filled with steroids in every clubhouse? No, I don't think it's ever going to be like that. But, I mean, who knows how attitudes towards, you know, performance-enhancing drugs, I guess you'll call them, how they're going to change, and how, you know, medical technology is changed already. I mean, you look at, you know, guys that are in the locker room getting cortisone shots every day and getting their, you know, knee strained and getting, you know, all these little miniature treatments and shots from team-approved doctors. And that's totally fine. And then, you know, they take something from their own physician, and that's, you know, that's an issue. It's complicated in my mind. I'd love to be directly on board with you and just say this game should be pure, everything should be, you know, but realistically I can't take that stance, just because, you know, knowing what I know about baseball history and knowing what I know about, you know, all these guys and trying to put myself in their position, I can see how it happens, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there always is the realistic standpoint, which I do agree with you on, but I just think that to try to at least, you know, in an ideal world, try to get rid of it is to inflict harsher punishments, but who knows if that'll actually work. So,
yeah, it's steroids is still, in my generation of baseball, you know, coming up in the early 90s when I started watching baseball and then through now, it's the defining point of our generation in this sport, and, you know, it's not going to change anytime soon.
Not at all. And looking at yesterday with that whole blemish there, there was, you know, a gem in yesterday, and that was Felix Hernandez's perfect game. Can't say we never would see it coming, because Felix Hernandez is that type of pitcher that, game in, game out, is going to end up eventually throwing a perfect game, and he did yesterday against Tampa Bay Rays, who now have 4 no-hitters thrown against them since 2009, 3 of them being perfect games.
It's 5 since 98.
And that's just crazy.
No team in history has been no-hit more than the Tampa Bay Rays.
You know, and there was the spot, because I was watching the end of that yesterday, where Joe Maddon went in the 7th inning and was trying to argue with the umpire and got ejected, and he was trying to, you know, break up Felix's rhythm, and I just thought, that's a little Bush League right there. But I mean, it was
a 2-1 count, too. That's the thing. Like, he argued a second strike call. I get it. If you want your guys to break up a no-hitter and you want to break up a perfect game, your guys have to do it at the plate. It should have been a ball. Yes, absolutely it should have been. But, you know, really, dude, you have to be able to tip your cap to someone. Joe Maddon's been in the league long enough to realize that, like, if this is happening right now, you know, we got to draw a walk and then try to bunt the guy over or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You do it the right way.
You know, and that's, I remember Verlander was going for a no-hitter last year, you know, one of his thousands. And I think it was Eric Ibar who did a bunt. And I think Verlander threw the ball and he made an error on the play. Not on purpose, on accident.
Yeah.
And he just gave, I think he gave Ibar like the dirtiest look and called it Bush League.
So. Well, it was like in Fires no hit performance the other last week, or was it 2 weeks ago now? I don't know. The days all blend together.
Yeah,
but you know, they had their number 5 hitter try to put down a bunt. Like, really, swing the bat, dude.
Yeah, you know,
it's so hard to see stuff like that, and I mean. You know, you want, again, going back to that, like, purity of the game issue, you want, you know, you hate to see stuff like that, because it's like, how do you not, you know, a guy like that, put a swing on the ball? Like, you're losing by enough now at this point. You know, bunting isn't a sound strategy in that situation.
Yeah, if you're going to try to break up a guy's no-no, do it the right way and try to keep your team in the game, not just, oh, I'm going to do it just to break up his no-no, I'm just going to do a bunt. No,
I mean, again, I understand you're down one to nothing. It's the 6th inning. they just had a walk with a guy on first base, and you're coming up and you're like the number two hitter. Yeah, absolutely, you put a bunt down in that situation, because if you had four hits, you'd put a bunt down in that situation. Mm-hmm. You know? But if you're down by five runs and you empty bases, one out, and you're the number four, number five hitter, number six hitter even, you're bunting to try to break someone's day. You're not bunting because what is that going to do for you at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you get out, it's two outs, you know, and then you got a man on first with one out and with the bottom end of your lineup coming up. You're not doing that to try to win that game. You're doing that to try to not be no hit. And I understand the impetus to not be no hit, but really do it the right way.
Mm-hmm. You know, and looking at 2012, there have been six, you know, no hitters thrown, three of them being perfect games. And the second one that Seattle's actually thrown, as they had one back in June, it was a combined Kevin Millwood and bullpen effort.
Right.
And there have only been two times that there have been seven no hitters in one season, 1991 and 1990. And in 1884, there were eight. So
right.
2012 has some pretty good company. It's tied with 1969, 1908, and 1917 for six no-hitters.
And it's the only time in baseball history we've had three perfect games in one season.
There was some guy who, I think it was the fake Buster Olney account on Twitter, if you follow
him. Oh, I love that.
He's like, I think the bigger story here is that the Seattle Mariners scored a run today. Like, that's a huge knock to Seattle fans, but you know.
Yeah. No, but they deserve it. Seattle fans are those types of fans that just it's hard to be a Seattle Mariners fan. It's since about 98, it's been really, really hard. You know, when they lost the Martinez brothers and Buehner and Griffey and all those guys in the early 90s, to then come back with just trying, and they had Ichiro for so long, and he's gonna get the 3,000 hits with someone else, and that's rough for them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say, well, you know, Ichiro's at the end of his course and blah 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 blah. No, admit it, you still want Ichiro back.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a good move for everybody, but for the fans, it's a little disappointing because Ichiro was your guy, you know.
Yeah, and fans try to play it off like, oh, well, we didn't need him anyway. Like, yeah, he still did,
but. I will say that Felix Hernandez is the pitcher that those fans deserve.
Yes, and if you watched it all, and I'm just saying in general, a general you, Felix Hernandez, I believe, has the biggest fan base of any player. Because mm-hmm. you looked at all the fans yesterday that had, there was a huge section of people with signs that said K on it.
Yep.
How many other people do you see have that many fans? That is crazy, and Seattle fans are loyal to Hernandez, and Hernandez likes Seattle. He doesn't want to go anywhere. He's not a champion chaser. He just likes pitching, you know, in general, and he likes pitching in Seattle. So, I mean, will Seattle eventually trade him? I think so, but I don't think it's going to be a huge team like the Yankees or the Rangers or the Red Sox. I think it's going to be another, maybe a mid-market team.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it will eventually happen, but for the time being, Felix is going nowhere.
Yeah, and he's got the stuff to do well for a really, really long time. I mean, you watch that windup, the way he hides that ball, and just the speed of his delivery is something that you don't see from, like, anybody. He's got that really tight windup, you know, and he just pushes that ball straight from the mound and throws his whole body behind it. And, I mean, his breaking stuff is just sick, and his fastball can beat anybody in the league. It's just... He's the kind of pitcher that, again, every team should just kill for.
Fun fact about yesterday's perfect game was Felix Hernandez had 12 strikeouts. All 12 came on breaking pitches. I think six of them were change-ups. One was a slider. I forget what the other one was. But all of them came on breaking pitches, and that is incredible. Because mm-hmm. guys will go through a game. You go through the lineup for the third, you know, time. Guys are going to know how you're striking them out. And clearly the Rays didn't, but...
Right. And, I mean, it's crazy, too, because he was changing speeds like crazy, like you just said. He was changing elevation on guys all game long. I mean, into the ninth inning, he was striking guys out with high curves. Like, it was impressive to see that kind of confidence in his stuff and that kind of attacking attitude where the Rays were just... I mean, it looked like they just didn't even care after the seventh. Like, everything they hit was a ground ball. It was very impressive.
You know, and he went inside a lot of the time, and that, you know, jams a lot of guys. And guys just gave up on that. You know, if it was a low ball inside, they just swung at it like they were golfing and just didn't even care. Because, I mean, you're not going to be able to hit that. And if you don't hit that, there's a risk of it being, you know, on the inside corner being called strike three. So you got to swing at it. But they look goofy swinging at it because it's just... Hernandez has this deception on his pitches and is just so good that it's just... Like you said, any team would kill to have a pitcher like him.
He's real, and he's really what he's really good at is getting the batters to shorten their swing up, like he said, by you know, heading inside and getting them to roll their hands over so that they can't get anything but, you know, dribbles to the infield or maybe a nice line drive, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, and just real quick, you know, ending this because we're way over the mark now. Hypothetically, a Brewer gets a no hitter or a perfect game. Who's it going to be?
My top two to get it are Yovani Gallardo or Mike Fiers. Mike Fiers is obviously a couple years away, as we discussed in our article. You know, getting his loss in the Rockies, he still has some refining to do. But I think he's got it in him the way he attacks hitters, and the way he can continually adjust throughout a lineup. And then when Yovani's on, I mean, Yovani is on. He went eight no hit innings last year, I think it was, versus the Cardinals, which is not an easy lineup to do it against, and he's a guy who can power through lineups, and when he's got that curveball working, he's almost unbeatable. So those would be the two I would say.
Yeah, and I have to agree there because it's just Yovani also has a very good slider as well, and his deception isn't like Felix Hernandez's, but he's still pretty good. And to be considered the ace of the Brewers even when Zach Greinke was there, that says a lot about you. So, I mean, and I don't know if that's giving too much credit to Greinke or whatnot, but, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Gallardo is an amazing pitcher. Fiers almost had a perfect game, and out of the many we've had this year, I mean, Hiroki Kuroda almost had a no-hitter against Texas the other day. Verlander almost had a no-hitter this year.
Cappy almost did.
Yeah, and, I mean, you're the pitcher. I mean, it's just crazy. But, yeah, I can definitely see Gallardo getting it. Fiers... Yeah, I mean, he has a lot of breaking stuff as well, and his and Thornburg's deliveries remind me a little bit of Tim Lincecum. Fortunately, they're not pitching like Tim Lincecum this year, but
not quite as wonky as Lincecum's is, because Lincecum has purely custom design.
Yeah, but I'd have to agree there. I don't see anybody else in Milwaukee going for it. I think the rest of it is just a pure just. Dream at that point, but I think if there's anybody going for it, it's those two. So,
yeah.
Well, it's been fun, so stay tuned for next week, guys, and thank you for listening.
Thanks, guys.